a very ambitious topic for me. And I was thinking that only three types of people would dare even talk about what we're going to talk about tonight. Someone who has either incredible chutzpah, okay, I don't know if you find it, but I think it's in the American Heritage Dictionary, everybody knows what it is. Or somebody who's extremely brilliant, or somebody who's a big fool. Right? And I'm not sure which category that I'm in. I just feel like maybe I'm slightly over my head. I'm not a Navi. Okay? I don't even think I had to make that announcement. But we're all very, very interested to understand what's going on around us. And we would think that a Navi, a prophet, pardon me if I use a word that somebody doesn't understand, so please wave me down, flag me down. That we think that a prophet is somebody who can tell what's happening into the future. But the truth is, the Talmud says that in the times of the first temple, there were keflaim, keyotim, and mitzrayim, neviim. There were 1 million, double the amount of the people that exited Egypt. There were 1,200,000 prophets, and only 48 spoke about future events. What were the others doing? The others, they could look into a situation. They could see somebody as they are right now, like a deep psychologist or somebody could read into a person and maybe help them to travel their life in a much more efficient way. This is what you should do for a living. This is who you could marry. This is where you should live. This is what you need for the vitamins that your soul needs. So in order to a prophet, we don't need a prophet to tell us what's going to happen tomorrow. We need a prophet. We need a Navi to understand what happened today, what happened yesterday, what's happening right now. A person would have to be a Navi to explain everything. And I'm not a Navi. I'm not a prophet. I'm not going to claim to understand things that nobody else could possibly understand. I don't have any messages coming down from heaven. But the Talmud says that if we're not prophets, at least we're the children of prophets. And I'm going to tap into not my words and not my ideas, not my concepts, but the concepts of the Talmud and people who had access to prophecy. And let's see the credibility of their words. And let's measure for ourselves. I don't have an axe to grind. I haven't got an agenda that we have to prove something, you know, rock solid that this is what's happening. But I think we're all terribly interested to try to figure out what's going on. The world is an unsettling world, and we can be made crazy nervous from the things that we see, and the things that we anticipating might happen. And I think tonight it's important that we leave with a feeling of hope and calm also, based upon the words, the comforting words of our sages. The Talmud says that the world, I'll just give a brief overview of human history. How's that? Okay? Just to understand, on Pesach night, we you know, I have like called a Lamb Haggadah. You're not collecting pictures, and, you know, a little archive of things that, you know, it's a notebook that gets bigger and bigger, heavier and thicker, with all kinds of pictures to pass around at the Pesach Seder to look over the course of 7 days. And I have a picture of a fella coming out of the desert. He crawls and he comes up to a sign, you know, that's like a blank piece of paper over there with an X on it that says, "You are here." You know? Very nice. It's nice to know you are here. You are here in the context of what map? But the same thing, you can go into a New York City subway map and you can see the whole thing and, you know, all the different lines and trains and options and opportunities. But if you haven't got that sign that says, "You are here," that little X over there. So we need both of them. We got to know you are here. We have to know what the map looks like. So the Talmud outlines that there's something called 6,000 years of history, based upon the 6 days of creation, and a statement from Psalms that says that a thousand years is like a day to the Almighty. So just like there were 6 days that went into creation, and then there was a Sabbath, so there are 6,000 years, 6,000 millennium that will unfold until comes the 7,000th year, and right now that would put us we're in the year 5,775. And anybody who is observing Shabbos now understands that on a long summer afternoon, a Friday afternoon, that if you go to the right minyan, you can actually take on Shabbos early. There's an opportunity to take on Shabbos a little bit early. We're actually in the period where we could take on Shabbos. If the thousands of years were divided into days, we're into that part of the day, the latter part of the 6,000th year. So we're in a special time. And they said the first 2,000 years are called 2,000 years of sohu vavohu, 2,000 years of void and nothingness. That's what these are the statements of the Talmud. What does that mean? That means that man left up to his own devices destroys and fumbles and disassembles a world that was originally perfect. You know, we'll start the chart, you know, way up on the height, or we'll picture a beautiful white, pristine picture, you know, and there's one little black dot in the middle. And Adam was told, don't eat from that one thing. Everything else is beautiful. There's one little spot. Don't touch that spot. You know what happens when you tell a kid, don't put a marble in your nose. It's just that right side. He starts to think to himself, you know, for whatever reason, whatever motivation man had, but that's what he did. He touched the button and started to bleed into the picture until the whole picture became gray and until the ink spilled out until the picture became one black picture at the end of 2,000 years. With one little white dot left in the middle. So the stock went effectively from the heights, from a perfect universe. Everything was set up. You moved into the beautiful new apartment. You know, here's your beautiful new apartment in Israel. Here it is. All of a sudden, down to the bottom, down to the pits, ruined, destroyed. The beautiful rental car, now totally destroyed. And now on the bottom of that picture at the end, we have a totally black universe that every piece is infected, is sullied with one little white spot. And what is that white spot? Comes the next 2,000 years, the Talmud says. 2,000 years of Torah. Who was born in 1948 from the beginning of creation, oddly enough? A man named Abraham Avinu, 1948. Okay, strange point. And at the age of 52, the Talmud says, he started to call out in the name of the Almighty. He had done research. He researched 3,000 religions and found them wanting. He researched the traditions that supposedly his father had handed down to him. He says, you know, why do we collect on Halloween candy? Why? Who says? What? He looked in and checked the sources and found out that nobody knows why they're doing what they're doing. And he saw a fractured world, and he posited what was Einstein's theory? I'm talking about the unified field theory of spirits and physics, both of them together. And he came to the notion that it's a unified world. It's a one. There's a oneness. There's a palpable oneness in the world. And when he came to that conclusion, using all of the powers of cognition that he had, so now he started to call out in the name of the Almighty, starting in the year 2000. And he stretched his information and he started to teach people. And now that little dot of light starts to spread out. And we all know, we go through the Pesach Seder, know a little history. He had an Isaac. Isaac had a Jacob. Jacob had 12. 12 became 70. They went down to Egypt. And they blossomed over there to hundreds and hundreds of thousands until it came to the Exodus. And there were maybe perhaps 2.5, 3.5 million people who exited Israel. And now suddenly the Jewish people are launched onto the stage of history. That's the beginning of the middle of the heart of the 2,000 years of Torah. And it begins to expand and expand and expand until about 2,000 years ago. And this is information now is raining since Abraham called out to the Almighty. Information is raining from above to below. That's why it's called 2,000 years of Torah. And one of my teachers had told us, he says, it's like a child that has a puzzle. And the puzzle comes complete. And then he pulls, it's in a frame. And the father said, don't pull the corner out the frame. Don't pull there's a little screw there. And everything will become disassembled if you do. And he pulls the screw out. And suddenly the picture starts to fracture into 2,000 little pieces, whatever and more. And now the kid is crying, the puzzle is broken, and the father says, I'll show you how to put the puzzle together. Let's see. The puzzle, everything fits. Everything puts the puzzle back together again. Isn't that beautiful? At the end of that 2,000 years, we're sitting with a temple in Jerusalem, and we're back to where we were before, and that light of Solomon is spreading throughout the world, and knowledge, and people are catching on to the idea of Hashem Echad, that there's one God in the world. And then what happens is that picture is shattered. The father takes the screw out of the frame. And why is that? Because in a certain way, it was our production, but it was with too much help from above. It's not our accomplishment. So the stock went from above all the way down to the bottom. It went from the bottom. It got taken all the way up to the top. And this is it came assembled. It was disassembled by man. The Almighty, the Father said, this is how you put it together again. Now, let's begin to disassemble it. And now you're going to have to put it together again. And Rav Tzadok HaKohen, one of the great minds of the 1800s, and he said like this. He says the last 2,000 years is called the epoch of Messiah, and those 2,000 years, he says, is a combination. You have an overlay, right, of the first 2,000 years of man left up to his own devices, does whatever he wants in the world, is capable of destroying the world, and at the same time, all the information that had rained from above to below is now been given over and granted to humanity. So now it's a slugfest between these forces of chaos and destruction, and hope and construction. So this is where we're at right now. The Talmud tells us in the end of Masechta Sota, a fascinating notion. There's so much stuff. If we had 10 hours, it wouldn't be enough, but we're going to condense it. We just went through 6,000 years of history. How's everybody feeling? Okay? Good? Going to catch our breath. What does the last period look like? So the Talmud tells us the following thing. And this is written 2,000 years ago. They tell us that when certain great rabbis had passed away, here's the introduction, things started to fall apart. Certain fine qualities were lost of humility. And certain fine qualities, we start to see, like, it's like a brand new car, that the shine is now starting to come off the car. And they're recognizing, you know, the car ain't what it, the old gray mare ain't what it used to be. You know, this thing, this machinery is starting to break down. And I said, what is it going to look like now that it's up on the top of the hill? What's it going to look like when it gets down to the bottom of the hill? What's it going to look like in the end? The end is going to be a little bit scary. And they fast forward to the end of the picture. The car on the top of the hill, the brakes come off, and now it heads down towards the intersection. And, you know, I don't want to look. The Talmud says, I don't want to be there. The rabbis of the Talmud said, let it happen, but let me not be there. It's a scary time. It's a scary time. And they begin to describe, what are the signs? They give 15 basic signs. I'm not going to try to sell and push any idea into any one thing. If there's something here that I don't know about, you know, I'm not going to, I don't want to be guilty of saying, you know, oh, he stretched an idea. If the shoe fits, you know, wear it. If it doesn't, you can use your imagination and let's see. This is what it says. This is what it begins to look like in the end of times. It's 15 signs that there's a Mishnah in Perkei Avos. Okay. Why should we listen to a Mishnah? Not Mishnah, a Mishnah, Perkei, Mishnah in the end of Sota. Why should we listen to a Mishnah? Remember one of my teachers, the dean of Or Sameach in Jerusalem. I worked with him for many years, Nota Schiller. He said that when he was in university, in John Hopkins University, so the professor, you know, he was a yeshiva student during the first two parts of the day. And in the evening, he was taking courses for his doctorate in John Hopkins University. And the professor said to him that was taking role, and he looked out, he was matching names with faces, and he finally gets to the letter S, Schiller. He sees this fellow with a yarmulke planted firmly on top of his head. He says, are you a student of the Talmud? He says, yes, I am. He says, what are you doing here? He said, whoa, you know, and Rabbi Schiller said, you know, I didn't even challenge him on any, you know, on anything yet. So why is he starting up with me? You know, so he said, you know, humbly, and the professor went on to explain. He said, he said, you know, if you're a student of the Talmud, he says, you know, this is a sociology class. And he says, and what I know about the Talmud, it's not a lot. He says, but I know that they were able to hold together a nation in disparate continents and disparate countries under difficult circumstances for more than 2,000 years, and that you remain a unified nation. He says, and anybody who could author and put together a document like that, he said, they have to be the greatest sociologist of all time. And this is a sociology class. He says, I don't think I can teach you anything. That was his introduction. Rabbi Schiller says, Professor Waterman, he says, I just want to put your mind at ease. He says, I only came here for the easy A. I never planned on learning anything. So the Mishnah has clout. And other things that we'll mention, we'll try to see if we can discern their credibility. And the Talmud says the following thing. The if but the Mashiach, when things are getting down to the wire, right before the end, because on Erev Shabbos, things are going crazy. And it's very hard to figure out what's going on. As a matter of fact, you know, one of the questions I once heard from one of my Rebbeim, he says that, you know, one of the 13 Animamis, the Rambam goes and he gives a 13-point, it's not how you build a car. But afterwards, New York State tells you how to inspect the car to make sure it's a fully functioning, running car. So it's different to what General Motors is doing, or what Chrysler is doing, or whoever it is, you know, or what any of the car manufacturers doing, and what the inspector is doing. Rambam came afterwards, and he says, you want to inspect the car, you want to inspect your Jewish heart, and know if it's built right, you have to look at these 13 fundamental principles of belief, just to make sure everything is lined. And one of them, number 12, is to believe that Mashiach is going to come. So one of my teachers once asked a very simple question. He said, that's a future thing. It's like you're looking at the car, and you're saying, there will be a stop sign. It's not about the car. It's about something that's going to happen in the future. That seems to be distant and abstracted from the person himself. It has nothing to do with the person. That there's a belief that Mashiach is going to come. There's an event that's going to happen in the future. That's the question. But the truth is, it does affect how we interpret and how we understand what's going on now. You know, because if a person goes to a play and they're watching a play, and it's going on 1, 2, 3 acts, and now people start to, you know, they're watching the play, and by the end of the play, it looks like, you know, the curtain is falling down and the actors are fighting. You know, there used to be certain actors that they carried out these types of plays, like Theater of the Absurd, you know. And someone sort of had to think that this is, you know, written by Eugene Ionesco. This is something like, you know, everything's gonna, it's gonna sizzle and pop, and you know. And at that point, you know, a number of people look at their watches and they realize, I have a babysitter I'm paying at home. In another hour, it's gonna click a steeper payment in the garage, and they get up out of their seats, you know, and they start to shuffle. They do the shuffle out of the theater, and they leave. And then you have a handful of people sitting in the theater, and they're watching as, you know, the ropes are falling down, and the stage is collapsing, and the people are fighting, and you start to see all those strings and the marionettes and everything that's happening, all the works that's happening behind that were not visible in the beginning. And it doesn't look like, and the plot gets so thick and complex, you wonder, like, how is anybody going to get out of it? You don't even know who done it or how they're going to get out of the situation. He says, but this, why are these people sitting there, the ones who are sitting there? Because they looked at the playbill, and the playbill says that this is not a Theater of the Absurd. This was written by Neil Simon. And he has a nice way of tying together neatly, like a Havdalah candle, all the different threads, and it all comes to some nice, you know, symphonic conclusion. He says, you know, we know that everything's going to make sense in the end. So we're staying in the theater. Because we looked at the playbill. So we look at the playbill, we understand that the world is authored by somebody. And things are happening in a sequence that we can begin to see what the we're not day traders, you know. We're like a friend of mine. He's into all, he knows certain movements in the stock market, and he doesn't look at the newspaper on a daily basis. The newspaper too scary for him. He says, but day traders always losing money, and he's, you know, he's value investing. He knows he's gonna stay to the end until the stock goes up, and he's always gonna make money that way. And he always does, and he has for the last 35 years. And that's why he's a billionaire, because he understands that it's more than just the subtle wrinkles of things that are happening on a daily basis. There's a big picture. We sat at the Pesach Seder and we said that these things the Almighty considered the end. And we want to walk away from the Pesach Seder with a sense that this promise that Abraham had lived with 3,700 years ago, that he was given, will stay with us to this very day. So we stay to the end of the show, and therefore it's not only that's one aspect, is that what we're watching, we have to understand, has to make sense to us. We have to understand that it will have a meaningful conclusion. That's a firm belief, and therefore it affects the way we interpret, the way we understand what's going on now. But another thing is, we're not just observers, we're players. And this is not a... So therefore every thread that goes out there and every part of the fabric of what's happening is part of a beautiful tapestry, an amazing painting. Therefore, we don't take any piece lightly, and we understand that it will all have some kind of profound meaning ultimately. We just may not know what it is in the short run, right now, on a daily, daily basis. So therefore, it says like this. It says, in the end of times, it says, if the Mashiach, when we get to the final end, the heel, there's a humanity which is being built, and the heel is the final, the conclusion. It's also the most callous part. You know, it's the most unfeeling part. It says, chutzpah yizgeh. There'll be a load of chutzpah. Chutzpah will be a proliferation of chutzpah. Chutzpah, what is chutzpah? I mean, everybody knows what chutzpah is, right? We said before, in the American Heritage Dictionary, what is chutzpah? What's the definition of chutzpah? What is the definition? I have a definition of chutzpah.
Jar of guts.
Guts. It's the temerity to step over a line, to violate a value of some kind. People willing to challenge an old-time custom. A kid talking back to his parents. That's a chutzpah. A student talking back to a Rebbe. My wife tells me she's a first-generation American. She said her father said that you know, in Europe, a teacher was a god. A teacher, an adult. People didn't talk back to their parents. Nobody talked back to their parents. And I'm not saying I'm clean from myself. I'm an American kid. Yeah, ma. Yeah, you know? One of the things that charmed me about my wife when I went to meet her was that when I went to pick her up, she says, Daddy, we're going out. He says, what time are you coming back? She was looking up to him like he was 17 feet tall. He was about 7 inches shorter than her, you know. Daddy, you know. And she looked up to him. He says, what time are you going to be back? She says, 12 o'clock. He says, okay. I said, where are you going to find a girl like that? You know, that knows what respect is. Not like, Daddy, tell me what to do. OMG, you know? You want me to inherit your money? Talk to me nice. You know, the Americans are my friends. You know? Chutzpah. People are violating their conscience, too. Chutzpah, the person violates their own conscience. Continues. He says, V'yoker yamir. The price of life will become very, very high. Some say, V'yoker yamir. Ya'amir is the Aleph Mem Resh root. It means speak. People are talking about money, the price. People are talking about prices of everything. I think it was Vince Scully who said that in all his, you know, 50, 60 years of sports announcing, baseball announcing, he never once spoke about the amount of money that this particular player earned. He talked about baseball. You know, this is his batting average, and this is his slugging percentage, and this is how he did it in the last game. But you talk about the guy's, you know, he's got a $17 million contract, and he's holding out for more, and then his options open up, and what are we looking at? Everybody's, what money is it? We talk about money all the time. But there'll be a high price of life. Everybody, we have a cleaning lady. Suddenly the phone goes off, and I says, oh, it's not my phone. It's the cleaning lady. She's there, you know, she's there. Cleaning lady's the phone. Everybody's got phones. Everybody, you know, is participating in that high life. Hagefen titen period. It says that the grapes will give off its fruit. The hayayin biyoker, and yet wine will be expensive. Anybody knows the basic law of economics understands supply and demand. So if there's a large supply, so why is the price so high? There's a lot of wine, tons of wine around, and yet the price is high. And Rashi says a very interesting thing. Rashi himself was a wine merchant, lived 1,000 years ago, and he gives a running comment on the whole Talmud and the 24 books of Tanakh, and he says, still, same principles apply. Supply and demand. There's a big demand. If there's a large demand, so then people are drinking more than unusual. It's a drunken, it's an intoxicated society. It's an escapist society. And you can add it up and you say, because people are doing acts of chutzpah, when a person does an act of chutzpah, when a person says something crude or rude to a teacher, to a principal, to a cop, to a, you name it, and they go home, they're sitting in there having a conversation in their head. And there's two conversations. One is saying, you deserve it, and the other part says, you fool. That little voice when they try to get quiet at night, you know, even after they're busy trying to argue and drill in their mind why they must be right, at the end, you know, there's a little whisper that we talk about on Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, called the Mamadaka, a little voice inside. And the person who drinks, you know, who feels that they, who didn't live up to their, do the right thing, they have to drink, they have to drown out that voice over there. So they have to keep to turn up the sound of the TV or whatever it is in every room. You got to get distracted and do something at a moment. You can't have a spare moment to think. Because if you think, then you might understand something about what's going on. It's too painful to think. It's too painful to be with ourselves, to be alone with ourselves. So yayin biyoker, it's a symptom, it's a sign of the times. It goes on. It's talking about a disassembling and a breakdown of society, about machas tahapich leminos. Countries that had values have no values anymore. They have atheistic values now are going to proliferate. The ain't tochecha, and there's nothing to stop it because there's no rebuke. Usually, sometimes somebody's doing something, you know, you say, hey, you know, stop that. Somebody's got to stand up and say something. Nobody can stand up and say something because anybody who says something, you know, like you say, that they say, if I point the finger at you, this is what Rashi says, that's my ideas. And you point the finger at somebody, don't forget you got three fingers pointing back at you. Everybody says, oh, you think you're so pure? You're so good? You also got a problem. This will be the way of neutralizing anybody who has any type of protest to say. They say, you know, you got skeletons in your closet, and therefore everybody's afraid to speak up, so there's no rebuke, and therefore things will accelerate at a certain rate. It says, Beis Vad Yeliznus, a place where people gathered for knowledge, become a place where people go to. Again, I don't want to overinterpret. A place where people go for lewdness. Right? Maybe people went for opera, maybe people went to university because of, but now it's a place where there's so much promiscuity around. You know, it's everywhere. Talk about, I remember one of my Rebbeim, he said he showed us a picture one time of, I shouldn't say, a prostitute at the turn of the century. look like the biggest rebbetzin. I'm telling you, with a sleeve that went beyond the wrist, you know, and a neckline, you know, like one of these climbing necklines, you know, oh, maybe a corset and a long skirt that went down that was also sweeping the floor, you know, and that was, you know, standing on a street corner something. And nowadays, right? And nowadays, I think it was Jack Parr. I can say things to this audience over here. I do believe, you know, I do believe that I can say things over here that I can't say in other places because kids don't know what I'm talking about. So maybe some people remember Jack Parr. I think he was off in 1959. You know why he got thrown out of the air, off the air from television? He was after him came Johnny Carson, right? So, you know why he got thrown off the air? Because he said the word water closet. And he refused to apologize in reference to the bathroom. One of my teachers said, he said when he grew up in Queens and he went to public school and his mother used to come to pick him up. You know, and he said, and they had a dress code. You couldn't come onto, you had to wait on the side. You couldn't come onto the school grounds in Queens, which is not the bastion of conservative America. In the 1950s, you couldn't come onto the school grounds. The mother couldn't come on if she was wearing slacks. You know, Lucy, I think, was the first one that, you know, like broke that, you know, okay. And in Elvis, you ain't nothing but a hound dog, and all of a sudden, you know, the Beatles, and now everything is possible and everything is done. What would a person have to not be wearing, or what would a person have to say to get thrown off the air nowadays? So the standard becomes much more diminished, much more. And that's what the mission is talking about over here. It says, talks about things, there's some global things that are happening. Baglil Yecharev, that the Galilee up in the north in Israel will be destroyed. I don't know what that means. Va'gablan, Yishom, and the borders will be destroyed. Va'anshe Gvul, Yisovu Mi'ir Le'ir, V'lo Yechanenu. I'm not going to try to overinterpret things. People traveling around from city to city and not finding rest. Chochmas Sofrim Tisrach, that people who used to value learning, who were Talmud scholars, they don't make them like they used to. Okay? Maybe there's a lot more people learning Torah. But sometimes you bump into an old Jew who knew, you know, we had an old Sephardi fella from Yemen. He came to our, he used to sit in our shop. He knew the entire Talmud. He would sit and he would recite. He knew the whole Tanakh. He knew the entire Talmud. He was a cab driver. But he knew more. He knows 10,000 times. He knows a million times more than me. He goes, oh, Rabbi Lam. I know Rabbi Lam next to this fellow over here. He knows everything. There were people around that knew everything. And now, people, I wouldn't have even been a shamish in a shul like that. They wouldn't even let me, you know, sweep up the floor. So we come on to, you know, I'm an usher in a theater over here with a little crumbs of knowledge are now taken to become the big rabbi, let's say. And then it says like this: wow, yirchet yimaso. People will despise people who yirchet. Used to be somebody has a fear of sin. Well, okay, so all right. If somebody had fear of sin, that's okay. I think it'll either go down or it won't go down like that. So, if somebody has fear of sin, so it's... No, we'll leave it down. If somebody has fear of sin, so it used to be like, wow, that, you know, they were a cautious person. Somebody who was careful not to, you know, cross a boundary between men and women. You know, like, you know, that was respectful. I say that when Roosevelt went to speak to... Aaron Cutler and a group of rabbis went to go speak to Rebbechel Ben Weissmandel. They went to speak to Roosevelt about bombing lines that were heading towards Auschwitz and the camps. So they couldn't get into them. So they ended up going to Eleanor, and she reached out to shake their hands, and they withdrew their hands, and they said, you know, and she was a little taken aback, and they said, and she said like this, but she said, because we don't shake a woman's hand. And she says, I wish my husband had that custom. That was her. There's boundaries in life. This is this one's wife. There's boundaries in life. And it used to be respectful that people had these boundaries. They respected Shabbos. They respected Kasher. They respected, this is held in high esteem. Now, a fellow becomes a Baal Tshuva. And his parents want to put him in an insane asylum. What happened to him? We gave you a nice bar mitzvah. You know? We better go check the mezuzahs and find out what we did wrong. became something that people despise for some reason. He's not with it. How many people tried to come over? They have to, you know, we have to get you, we have to put you in touch with this. We're going to try whatever you can do to get the, at least steer the children back into the same misery loves miserable company. We're going to steer you back also into the dark soup of the world. They don't have a TV. They don't have, I'm not saying making any value judgments, but, you know, there's a heavy pressure. So don't be like that. We understand it. Part of us feels that way too. I understand. But where does it come from? It's the opposite of the way it used to be. Something changed. There was a dramatic shift someplace. And then it goes on and says like this, wow. The emes tehei nederes, the truth will disappear. Truth will evaporate. And the Marsha says an interesting explanation. Nederes, it goes off the Talmud, says actually in Edarim, the truth will disappear in groups like little flocks. Which means there'll be small interest groups. There's no truth. Everybody's fighting for their little in the Congress of Life for their little piece of their little action group or their piece of the pie of the world. But what's the truth? No. Nobody's for the totality to understand what's going on in general. Everybody's for this little piece of it and that little piece of it, our little small interest group, and we'll vote and we'll sell ourselves out for something small. But the totality of truth, there's no truth. It's only parties. Parties and parties. Parties and self-interest groups and interested self-interested groups. But what's the truth? To do the right thing. It's not a concept. It's not an ideal anymore. And this is some of the sad truths. Na'arim p'nei zekeim yelbinu. That the youth will embarrass and disgrace the face of the elders. You know, I guess in a fast-moving technological culture, a person doesn't know, even a presidential candidate doesn't know how to use a computer properly or something like that. Doesn't know, you know. So he's just old hat. It used to be the longer the older you were, the wider your beard. This was a diploma, you know. You have experience. Lady, tell us something. You saw more life, you know. You had more experiences. You have the history. You have the diploma of hindsight, of wisdom, of experience in life. But now, what do you know about the world? It's a changing world. So it's a youth culture. Everything is youth. We'll do everything to remain young. Only the young are worthwhile. Everybody else can be cast away. And then it continues, as a kainim yamdu mibnei katanim, that the elders will stand up. The elders will stand up and rise out of respect for the young. Ben menaval av, a child will act in a brazen way and will be disgusting in front of his father. Used to be maybe he had to hide, maybe he had to be shameful about the things that he was doing, but now he'll do it openly right in front of his father. Again, I don't want to speak out too many things that things that can happen today that never would have happened 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. You mentioned the intermarriage rate. Okay, let's talk about it and open relationships that people had that, you know, that were never spoken about before. My grandfather was one of 10 children, and there was one that he moved out to California. Uncle Morris, he got intermarried. But he would never be able to sit over there in front of great grandpa. Never would have happened in 1,000 years. He would at least, you know, he moved the distance away. He carried on his life out there. But now it's not that way. And relationships are open, and people are hanging out with each other in ways and hooking up in ways that, you know, without, you know, with the parents' consent and the parents' blessing. And it's, what's going on? What happened? What happened to the values over there? Ben menava, bas kama b'ima, daughter will get up against her mother-in-law. I mean, against her mother. Kala b'chamosa, daughter will get up against her mother-in-law. And I remember learning this with some prisoners a number of years ago when I said this line and everybody burst into tears. Couldn't believe it. Oy ve'ish anshe beso. The enemies of a person will be the members of his own household. We're talking about the disassembling and the breaking down of the nuclear family. Nuclear family. What happened to family? What happened to the value of family? People, so much fighting, so much infighting. If the values are not right, so that and as a result, so there's no inertia in culture. There's no sense of continuity. Pnei hador k'pnei hakelef. This is one of the more obtuse notions of it, that the face of the generation will be the face of a dog. Wag the dog. Wag the president. Wag the, you know. They'll take an opinion poll. This is not my idea. This is Rabbi Yosef Salanter. It said that, you know, a person will go out and he'll walk his dog. The face of the generation is the leader of the generation. It's like a dog. First, you see a person walking his dog in the morning, and the dog looks like he's out in front, and, you know, and then finally when he gets to a parting of the ways, he's trying to figure out which direction, which way do we go, George? He turns around to see what his master wants. Person wants to make a decision of what to do. The leader, you know, You know, what do the people want? Let's take an opinion poll and find out what the people want. He's not leading the people. He's leading the he's following the people from in front. Pnei Hador, Pnei HaKelev. It's a lack of a lack of leadership. Haben Einu Mizbayash Mipnei Aviv. A child will not be embarrassed from his father. Valmi Yeshla Hishayne. Now the Talmud comes to the conclusion of it. He says, we got no one to rely on. There's no one to rely on. Can't rely that things just go on their own anymore. They're no automatic. Can't rely on culture. Can't rely on family. Can't rely on community. Can't rely on the countries. Can't rely on there's nothing stayed. There's nothing stable. That's what we're talking about. Destabilization. And then it says, Einanu Lehisha Ein. We have no one on who to rely. He says, Alavino Sheba Shemayim, except our Father in heaven. So with the great Bali Musa, they said, oh, you know, it's not like, oh, no, guess we have no one to rely on. So we might as well rely on the Almighty, you know. No, he says, that is the job of that time, is to learn. We'll speak about it in the end. I have a very important and practical point. Is not that, oh, we have no one who's right. We have to, our eyes turn when we've let go of all the straws of life. We realize that, you know, the car is spinning on the highway and everybody suddenly becomes, there's no atheist in the foxhole. That's the job of that time, is to come to rely on the Almighty. And then it goes back and it spells out the words of the Brisa that the Sefer Mesil Shesharim, I see that Rabbi Zaitchik gives a class on that subject, is built upon that where the individual begins to build himself up, think global, act local. You know, the person begins to reconstitute and reconstruct his own personality and his own belief based upon an individual belief, and he builds the whole thing back up to the top until it gets to the end, until we're entering, we get to the, back to the top of the mountain again. Everybody individually. So the final conclusion can't be something that was gifted to us from the inertia of culture, like someone traveling through a tunnel. One of my Rebbeim had said over very pithily, and as he's going through the tunnel, so at some point he exits the light from the back of the tunnel. And he ends up into a dark place before he starts to see the light that's going to come at the front of the tunnel. I'd like to share with you something that we're going to turn, I think, now into the... You can see if any of this fits, if anything looks like it's unique, then it means that we're living in the times of Mashiach. And it feels, to me, it feels like, as of 50 and 60 and 70 years as of Chofetz Chaim, it said that we're entering into this period, you can already begin to feel that these times were coming. But now we're actually witnessing it, the undressing of the world and the undressing of the values, and the stage is falling down and the curtains are open and it looks like the people, there's no one to respect and there's nothing to respect and there's no president and there's no leaders and there's no, you know, and there's no one to stop it, and it's and the brakes, there's no brakes, and we're banging on the cockpit door. I'm going to ask you to reserve a question. If it's still relevant, if I didn't answer until they get to the end, because I'm afraid to go get hit by a canadal and suddenly go off into in a different direction. When 9/11 happened, I reached to a book on my right-hand side. Was it 12? How many years ago now? Was it 13, 14 years ago? I forget now. Yeah. I reached for a book on my right-hand side, and I took off this piece of paper that I'm about to read to you right now. I took it off the shelf. I had been in Israel the year before. I'd taken my son to Israel for his a month before his bar mitzvah, and I took off this book from the shelf, and I was in a shul in Israel, and I saw this page, Parshas Lech Lecha, and I said, wow, that's amazing. You know, I said, based upon what I read over there, I came back to America, I looked and researched where I could find this particular Chumash. This, you know, it's in five parts. It's called Mikras Gedolos, I think it's Habahir, which means with a Zohar targum, with a Hebrew translation of the Zohar, selected Zohar. I said, okay, interesting. But I saw something. Then that morning, plane one, plane two. Okay, everybody has their own feelings, their own emotions of what they were sensing and what they were experiencing that day. And I reached off the shelf. I called a friend of mine. I said, Zev, my friend in Boston, who grew up in Eastchester also. And I said, listen, what I'm about to read you. I don't spend too much time going into the wrinkles and the details over here. But we know that Abraham, by the age of 99, he was visited and he was given a promise, you're going to have a child. Right? But 13 years earlier, he was given a handmaid and he was given a child. But when he was told he's going to have a child from Sarah, good news. So Abraham, you know, sort of like jumped for joy. He was excited about it. But then he let one line escape from his a prayerful line escaped from his heart. And that line is, Vayomer Avram El Elohim. Avram, now when he heard the good news, turned back to the Almighty. And he said, Lu Yishmael Yechia Panech, if only Yishmael would live in front of you. Oh, I don't want to lose out on my little boy Yishmael. You tell me I got good news for Yitzhak. What's going to be with Yishmael? Yishmael is the father of the Arab nation. It's unbelievable. We live in a world where the Arab world is coming from Yishmael, who's the son of Abraham. Okay, let's understand that and appreciate that. And the whole Western world is coming from Rome. The Roman Empire is coming from Esav, which was the brother of Yitzchak. I'm sorry, the son of Yitzchak and Yaakov. So, all that takes place in a little family story in Parshas Chayisara, in Parshas Toldos, you know, in Chumash. Think about it, it's a fascinating thing. Therefore, we have a billion and a half Arabs and a billion and a half Christians, right? And they're all coming from, born from the children of that, of those little family stories over there. Now you go to try to tell me who's going to be important 5 years from now, or even at the end of this year, or 6 years from now. But the Chumash is telling us who's going to be important 3,700 years, right, into the future. It's like here we are sitting, and the ball, you know, the home run comes out, and it comes out of the TV and into our hands. It's an incredible thing. You go to try to figure out who's going to be important 3,700 years from now or 100 years from now. Whose name, which presidential name, which family is going to be prominent and still active on the planet. And yet, it's told that Yishmael has a certain role to play. We'll see. And Esav has a certain role to play. It's interesting, just to analyze on the side for 1 minute, is that the Arab world is keeping they keep Friday as their holy day. You know, that's their Sabbath. Even though they know that Shabbos is Saturday, Shabbos is Shabbos. They keep Friday. They moved off. They said, you know, we'll sit over here. And the Christian world, we all know, moved off to Sunday. But they have a billion and a half over here and a billion and a half over here. And we know which day, and we could never move it, even if we lost it or wanted to lose it. We always know that we're sitting stuck in the middle over here. Shabbat. That's Shabbat. And everybody agrees. They both agree to the Ten Commandments. There's a Shabbat, but this is the Shabbat. Here we sit in the middle. The Arab world keeps a lunar calendar. That's why Ramadan goes backwards every year throughout the year. It's 11 days short of the solar calendar, which is 365. It's 354 days. It's 29 and a half times 12. And therefore, it marches backwards, right? The Christian world is keeping a solar calendar, 365 and a quarter days. The Jewish calendar, so Pesach should always come out in Chodesh Aviv, the Talmud recommends, and the Torah recommends, that we have an adjusting calendar. It's a lunar calendar with a solar adjustment. So it gets pushed up. We have a leap year every 3 or 4 years, and it gets bumped up a month. It gets added on, so that Pesach always comes out in the springtime. So they have this, they have that, and we have somewhere in the middle. Yishmael, we'll see in a second, is the word, the essence of the word. Root word is Shema, right? Yishmael, because he cried, and the Almighty heard his cry. We'll see. Reb Chaim Vital says he'll actually cause that the Jewish people will cry in the end of times. That's going to be his ability, is that he'll create cry. He'll create a cry of prayer. But that's Shema. And Esav means Asu, Ayin Sin Vav, is the root to do. When the Jewish people accepted the Torah, right? This one believe in the next world. They'll do everything, they'll jump to the next world, for whatever it's worth. And these ones believe in building up the paradigm of this world. And when the Jewish people accepted the Torah, what did they say? Anybody remember that unanimous cry? Naseh, we're going to do it, v'nishma, and we're going to understand. We'll do in this world, we'll understand what the results will be in the next world, ultimately. We're doing it, and then we're going to learn about it. That's the right blend. These ones are heavy on the Yishmael, and they're famous for, and they're despised for, They're don't-dos. They're going to try to create a world where it's oppression and all the things that you can't do. Losa says, there's 365 don't-dos, the Torah says. But they're counterbalanced by 248 ases, which are do's. These ones are into the world of doing. You can't get to your destination only with right turns, and you can't get to your destination only with left turns. You've got to be able to have, the truth has to have the combination of the proper appreciation of when left and right, and when don't and don't do, you know, all the sensitivities that are involved. That's halakha. That's Jewish law. It's the truth. Trying to find out what the right balance point is, taking into consideration all of the sensitivities involved. So now, I'm going to fast forward through this. So he says, oh, if only Yishmael would live in front of you. So he says, Nenach Rabbi Chiya. Rabbi Chiya gave a groan. This was 2,000 years ago. 1,600 years ago. Pasach Ba'amar, and he opened up and he said, "Ay, but the he Sarah Akara Ve'en Lav Lot." Going back earlier in times when Avram started on his journey, and it said that Sarah was voted least likely to make it into the 21st century, because she was barren and she had no children. Not only didn't she have children, but she was barren; she was incapable of having children. Vayal Zeh, woe about this. Vayal Osa Hazman, woe to that time she yalda Hagar as Yishmael, because she couldn't have children. So Avram came up with Sarah came up with a scheme: take my handmaid Hagar, and Hagar had Yishmael. And that was the birth of the blues. Amalo Rabbi Yossi. Lama hari la, ya, lama. Vahari yalda sara akakak. Sara did give birth to a Ben Gezer Kodesh, to a holy child, to Yitzhak. Yitzhak was born. Samalo roani, I see, via ataro yusi, vani roi, and I see. Kach shamati mipi Rabbi Shimon. This is what I heard from Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, whose your site is coming up on Lag BaOmer. He says, Inyan al ze ani bof. This is what I'm crying about. Vayal Hazman, woe to the time of who she lifi, Shesara Nisakva. Since Sarah was held back, I'll just go to the English over here. It's written that Sarah said to Avram, "Please come to my nurse and my maid and have a child and give birth to a child as a surrogate mother." And because of this, the window opened up for Hagar to disinherit or to upstage Sarah, her mistress, and she had a child from Avram. So what's the problem? So Amar lo, Rabbi Yishmael said, "Whoa!" And I'm sorry, Avram said, "If Yishmael should live in front of you," and even though the Almighty said that He told him, "You're going to have Yitzhak," it's good news. So still, Avram never let go of his son Yishmael. And a Kodesh Baruch Hu and the Almighty said to him, answered back, and he says, "You know something about your son Yishmael? He's going to turn out to be a big nation, and he's going to have a role to play. We'll see what his role to play is in a second." And then afterwards, he was circumcised, and he entered into a covenant before Yitzhak ever came in. So you see, the Arabs actually make a bris at the age of 13, just like Yishmael back then had a bris at the age of 13. They make the same thing. So he had a head start, Yishmael. So now comes the action. Now come and see. The Talmud says, the Zohar says, come and see. 400 years, he says. The Tsar, the angel of the children of Yishmael, is standing from the Almighty and petitioning in the UN on high, and he says to him, he says, "Somebody that was born, does he not have a portion in your name? Someone who had a circumcision, doesn't have a portion in your name?" And the Almighty says, "Yes." So he says, "Yishmael, he had a circumcision. And doesn't he also have a portion in your name? Just like Yitzchak?" And the Almighty says, you're right. The Jewish people get the land of Israel because Yitzchak and the Jewish people are getting circumcision. So he says, Yitzchak, the Almighty answers, he was circumcised in the correct way. There was a certain halachic way to do it. And there's a few steps to it. And that's how his was done. And it was done in a perfect way. And these ones are not done that way. It's only doing in one aspect of it. He says, but these ones, he says, they come to me when they're 8 days old. That's this week's Parsha. Parsha's Tazriah. But they talk about the mitzvah of a child getting a bris milah. 8 days. So he didn't, he was close to the Almighty. That bottle was uncorked to the child to have a closer to the Almighty right from the beginning. These ones wait till 13. They give such a head start to the passions of their personality. And these ones, they stay far away for many, for a long time. So he says, but Stephen, still, the angel says, they deserve something. There's some kind of booby prize. And says, okay, you know, so we'll give him some kind of a prize. Doesn't he deserve some kind of prize? So they said, woe to that time that they got a little bit of a head start and they were able to open up their mouths and say that Yishmael deserves something. And since Yishmael came into the world ahead of Yitzhak, so he deserves something. And he says, what did the Almighty do? He pushed away the children of Yishmael from the closeness. They weren't kept at the front in the front seats. He says, from the high, lofty attachment. And he gave to them a chelik, he gave them a portion below in the Eretz HaKadosha, in the Holy Land, beglal osa hamilah shebam, because of their, they do have a circumcision. So they do have a certain closer to the land. Crunch time here. Just pay attention for the next few moments, and it's going to get into things that are beyond our sight. Asidim, in the future, b'nei Yishmael lishlod be'eretz Kadosha, in the future, and it happened that the children of Yishmael, the Arabs, ruled over the land of Israel for 1300 years, when the Jewish people were in exile. Right? The Ottoman Empire, whatever, the Arab world, they were sitting over there until, you know, the early 1900s, and it wasn't quite there wasn't the 1948, but 1948. So then there was a cosmic shift. He says, "Kemosha milasha hem rekanis bli shlemus," just like their circumcision is empty. It's without perfection. Hey, but they're going to try to prevent the Jewish people from returning. Who would have thought the Jewish people are going to return after being out of the land for 2,000 years? Except that the Torah says you're going to come back to the land. The Torah says it explicitly. Who would have thought that somebody who's out of the land for 2,000 years is going to come back? But when they're going to come back, they're going to run into a wall over there. They're going to come back to resistance. Because these ones say the lease is up. He says, no, the lease is not up. And that's what's going to be the discussion. Your lease is up, your lease is not up. He says, Ad shetikla osa hazchus, until their lease is up and they've lost all their merits of the Bnei Yishmael. V'asidim Bnei Yishmael, l'orem l'chama chazaka ba'olam. And in the future that the Bnei Yishmael are going to wake up a big war in the world. That's what the Zohar says. And when those planes hit, I said to myself, that's what I looked at a year ago. Boom! That's what happened. Chutzpah, they're starting up the whole world. They're stoking the world. Unashamedly. Unabashedly. Talk about chutzpah yiske. That's their kirev movement. Their kirev movement is, we're going to push you, we're going to intimidate you, we're going to bully you into our ways. That's not Rabbi Zaitchik's approach. It's not the Jeb approach. Maybe a piece of kugel, cheesecake, cholent, you know, some tea. Yeah, something, so, you know, a smile, a handshake, patience, some counseling. You know, that's how you win people's hearts. That's how you win the minds and hearts of humanity. But they're going to wake up a war in the world, not just a war for the land of Israel, a war in the world. Okay, and then we'll conclude on this part. Yasu b'nei Edom aleihem, and Edom, the other side, is now going to make a coalition against them. He says, "V'yorum mukhama behem, achas alayam." They have wars. This one with the other, that one with the other. It says until it comes in. Fast forward until it's going to come. Eventually, it's going to come to the point where Hashem l'melech al kolaris v'yomu yeshem achad shemochad. But it's painful. We're in a birthing process over here. This is what we call, you know. It seems like we're in the times. It's a scary, scary time. And this time of Gog and Magog, there's a big clarification going on in the world. There's a lot of fighting. The Talmud speaks about that. That King David wrote 150 Psalms, and Psalm number 2 is about this war. And what does he say? He says the following thing. Again, I want to. It's not to bash, but it explains. King David again is writing 3,000 years ago. He says the following thing. Lama rog shagoyim. Why are the nations congregating? UN. Lu'umim yegorik. And why do the people make worthless plans? Yisyatsu malchei aretz, he says, and why do the kings set themselves? V'roznu yozdu yachad, and their rulers take counsel together. And he says, al Hashem, against Hashem, v'al Mashicho, and against his anointed, against the Jewish people. They're trying to throw off the yoke of the Jewish people. Here the UN gets together and declares, what is the big problem in the world? Who is the big violator in human rights?
Israel.
That's the problem. If they would only get off that land, everything would be okay. If they'd only exit Gaza, then we can really plant flowers and have peace. And no one believes it. But yet somehow there's a pressure. There's a birthing pressure. There's a birthing pressure that's going on. We're in a birthing room. Listen to what Rav Hirsch says on this. They all consciously or unconsciously have one common goal. We should understand this. Namely, to emancipate themselves from the sovereignty of the one supreme principle, that of dutiful obedience to the moral law of God, which came to their awareness through the historical fact of the existence of his people and his anointed. Conscience. And they don't want to accept it. Only to this law did God promise his aid and furtherance. And upon this law did God build his world order. And only through the observance of his law can the nations attain enduring peace in their domestic and foreign relationships. The refusal to swear allegiance to this moral law because of considerations of personal interest, power, fame, wealth, is the reason for the unhealthy internal and external relationships of the lives of the nations. Instead of seeking a cure for this state of affairs upon the only path that leads to the true goal, all the leaders of the lives and activities of the nations are perversely engaged in a fight against the sole principle of salvation. The cure actually lies precisely where they think they can find the cause for their troubles, while they seek the cure in that which actually only aggravates the lingering evil. He's writing 150 years ago, refers on that verse that talks about what's happening at the end of times. Did King Solomon know that the nations of the world, and King David know that the nations of the world are going to gather together against the Jewish people? They're going to be in exile for so many years, and they're going to come back. It's a wild, 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 notion. There's one idea more, and then finally one little point to put at the end of it. You know, in the end of that, Parshas told us. So we know that Esav did something. You know, I think about this all the time. I take a look at what's happening in Europe right now. And right now, it's accelerating right now to Europe, to Italy, and anybody who knows anything of what's going on in France, and a little bit in England also, and in Germany, and the Netherlands. You can't say anything you want. You can't speak up against this force which is now embedded within the country. So, interesting thing happened. The end of Parshas told us. Again, ancient history, 3,700 years ago. So Yaakov was not so... Yaakov was sent away because he took the bracha from his brother Esav. And Esav, which is the Western world, which is the European world, was very upset. He's upset forever. Remains upset. He's going to be the watchdog, he was told. You're going to watch out. Only if your brother's worthy of the blessings. But if he makes a mistake, you're going to be watching him with a magnifying glass, with a microscope. If he shouldn't make a mistake. So we're judged on an infinitely higher standard. So what happens is, so Yishmael, we had in this last week's Parsha that there's certain animals that are representing different nations. It said that Yishmael is associated with a camel because he has all the internal signs. It chooses cut, but doesn't have the external signs. Not doing good actions on the outside, not pleasing to the outside world. The pig, on the other hand, is Esav, because he puts his hooves out and says, "You see, I got the split hooves. I'm a kosher guy." He's really trying to look like he's kosher, but on the inside, it's not really his motive. Is not a clean motive. So, in the end of the parsha, when Yaakov runs away, and now Esav realizes that his parents are not happy because he married the wrong girls, the local girls, the Hittite ladies. So he went and he married right at the end over there a daughter, the daughters of Yishmael. He hooked up an unholy marriage of convenience with Yishmael, with the Arab world. And because he did that, so Rashi says over there, points out interesting things. Like, look, now I'm a kosher guy. See, I married the right ones. I married someone from the family of Abraham, so I'm back in good graces. Rashi says, it doesn't say that he divorced the local girls, which he should have disassociated himself strongly. He should have cut those seven. He went and he did a symbolic act to show, you see, I'm kosher, and I took something on top. He added wickedness on top of wickedness because it's only a symbolic external act. There was no real change on the inside. He didn't do that. So many years ago, 75 years ago, right? We just had the March of the... there was a war. 6 million Jews perished in Europe. 6 million. My wife lost her whole family. I'm sure we all have no people and have family and extended family. You don't even know about that. That were lost. 6 million Jews were killed in Europe. And a fellow writes, so now Europe is getting a big wave, a washback of something terrible is coming to them. And they're always very much against Israel also. Always picking and always focusing on the bad in Israel. They figured after what they went through, they would have changed their mindset on that. But they didn't. This generation is now having something come back because... Listen to this. This guy writes an article. Pardon me if it's too spicy. His name is Sebastian Villa Rodriguez. Maybe some people heard it. I think he said he took a pseudonym. He writes it in 2008 in Spain. He says, "I walked down the streets in Barcelona and suddenly discovered a terrible truth. Europe died in Auschwitz. We killed 6 million Jews and replaced them with 20 million Arabs, Muslims. In Auschwitz, we burned a culture of thought, creativity, and talent. We destroyed the chosen people, truly chosen, because they produced great and wonderful people who changed the world. The contribution of this people is felt in all areas of life, science, art, international trade, and above all, as the conscience of the world. These are the people we burned, and under the pretense of tolerance, and because we wanted to prove to ourselves that we were cured of the disease of racism, we opened our gates to 20 million Muslims." There's that wedding over there. "Who brought us stupidity, ignorance, religious extremism, lack of tolerance, crime and poverty due to an unwillingness to work and support their families with pride. They have blown up our trains, turned our beautiful Spanish cities into third world drowning in filth and crime. Shut up in the apartments they receive free from the government, they planned the murder and destruction of their naive and native hosts. And thus, in our misery, we have exchanged culture for fanatical hatred, creative skill for destructive skill, intelligence for backwardness and superstition. We have exchanged the pursuit of peace of the Jews of Europe and their talent for a better future for their children. their determined clinging to life because life is holy. For those who pursue death, for people consumed by the desire for death, for themselves and others, for our children and theirs. What a terrible mistake was made by miserable Europe. Wow, what an exchange. And Europe is now living with, you know, I think it was Winston Churchill who said that the wheels of history grind slowly but thoroughly. Again, Rahman al-Slan, my heart goes out to our brethren, the people who live in Europe. But the Jews over there are constantly getting the message, it's time to leave Europe, and they're going to be flowing into the land of Israel. The Jews of America, the time will come also, they're going to come back into the land of Israel. This is called the Hevle Mashiach, the birth pangs of Mashiach. That's what we're into right now. That the Almighty, that the truth and the recognition of what's going on is being clarified in the world. That there are large parts of what was called religion are being discredited right in front of the whole world. They can't speak with credibility. Half a truth, like half a car, doesn't work. It has to be something which is total truth. It has to be something which is a delicate and a sensitive truth that takes into account all of every jot and tittle. We have a Torah that's paying attention to every. You can't make up things. You can't make up with the Almighty. You can't decide the Almighty says to do this thing and do that. So we're coming to a clarification. The world, Talmud says, will merit Mashiach should come that 7,000th year, or as we're approaching it, can come earlier in the merit of tshuva. And the Talmud says, so what if we don't do tshuva? It's a free will act. What if we don't repent? He says, then I'll send you a melech, a king. That's kasha kahaman. That's as harsh as haman. You know, who will cause the people to be scared, and they'll come back to that point over there. Well, this is a frightening time. We went through communism. We went through socialism. We went through a lot of even materialism. Now we're into something called terrorism. And how do we deal with terrorism? Okay, this is why I want to finish up with this little picture of hope over there. And it's not so easy being in the birthing room. I was there a number of times. In Hara, we have 10 children. You know, so I was there a few times. A few times they threw me out. Okay. One time I was there with my wife. I'll never forget this moment over here. What a moment. It was like, you know, the first four were easy. For me, anyway. You know, nobody knows what the men go through, by the way. You know. and then our fifth was a little beautiful baby girl, Sarah. She got married, Baruch Hashem, this last summer. Wonderful, wonderful, amazing kid. But the birthing room was carrying on like 5-6 hours. It was going on and on and on. The other ones, you know, okay, went there and, you know. And this one, carrying on for hours. I never forget. I'm in the corner, you know, sort of saying my psalms and doing my devotions and, you know, trying to care more, caring a lot and not being able to do too much. And all of a sudden, the nurse, the birthing coach, was a very nice, you know, she was stroking my wife's hand. She was very, very gentle. And she said to my wife, I'll never forget this moment, I'm listening. She says, dear, you give one more little push, and you're going to have your baby. And I remember between, you know, the waves of what's it called, contractions. Okay, I think I'm having one right now, as a matter of fact. just talking about it. Between the waves of contractions. So my wife, I remember she looked up at that moment over there, that pause, and she said, baby? And I remember thinking, what did she think we came here for? what is this, some kind of a glorified dentist office? like you're sitting in stirrups, you know, taking out a wisdom tooth. You know, we know what we know here. We had 9 sonograms. We came into the hospital and triage. You know, the genius over there, you know, asked us, you know, can we help you with something? You know, and I told him, yeah, I'll give you 3 choices. I'm having a bad hair day. You know, I have an ingrown toenail. My wife is about to have a baby. You know, so we admitted it. We knew why we were coming into the hospital. We had a wheelchair. We brought her up, and there, 5 hours later, is this going on? And I'm thinking, what's this? She said, no, we're having a baby. Is this the first time she's finding out about it? And I thought about it, and I realized it's an important psychological point, because when the person's going through pain, they don't see the big picture. It could be the most obvious production in the whole world, and it's not so easy when the production is not obvious. But we're sitting there in the birthing room. We have 6 million Jews in the land of Israel. The baby's head is down. And we're waiting for one more little cry, one more little push, and you're going to have your baby. And one tekiah gadola later, and suddenly, we have a beautiful child in our hand. We're the most valuable ingredient, the most valuable element in the entire universe, a human child. A human life. And when a person is going through the pain, psychologically, we're just thinking about the pain. The pain is eclipsing and it's overshadowing the notion that there's something good, that there's something, that something's happening. Something good is happening. Something's happening. And all we can think about is the pain. But we're producing something. Something great is about to happen. Kol mavasir, mavasir va'omer. Kol mavasir, mavasir va'omer. We have to be ready to hear good news. So here's the cure. It is what to focus on. And I'll just finish up with this. I have a question that bothered me. I went to see a big tzaddik, very, very big tzaddik. I don't know if you ever had a chance to meet Rabbi Mordechai Schwab. You ever seen Rabbi Mordechai Schwab? He was a real tzaddik. And I think it was when my wife was expecting the first time. We went to see him. We were nervous. I was nervous. What to expect? What's going on? Guitar. And he showed us two verses in the book of Devarim, the book of Deuteronomy, and they're underlined in his Chumash, and it says over there, don't be afraid. It's talking about the nations and the armies are gathering around you, and they're clashing, and they're making clamoring and making noise, and they're intimidating noises. And the Torah says, don't be afraid of them. Lo sirim mehem, don't be afraid of them. Now when he said it, it calmed my nerves. And he pointed out, it says, Rabbeinu Yonah, one of the great Jewish minds 1,000 years ago, says, it's one of the 613 mitzvahs, not to be afraid. Don't be afraid. But it bothered me afterwards, even though when he said it with his soothing voice, I was not afraid after that. He took away all my fear. Because the Torah says, don't be afraid. The Torah says, don't be afraid. Forbidden to be afraid. Forbidden. Don't be afraid. But then later on, I thought about it, and I tried it on some other people myself. It doesn't work. It's like if somebody's picking on a kid, and they're going through emotional, don't let them bother you. Right? You know, that never works. You take the beach ball, you try to push it all the way down to the bottom of the pool, and the more you try to push it down to bury it in the pool, the more it wants to run up. Somebody's going through an emotional thing, they're afraid, you tell them, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Oh, the more you say, don't be afraid, the more people are afraid. So what's the point of telling people, don't be afraid? I don't understand the Torah understands human psychology. So how could the Torah come and tell people who are afraid, don't be afraid? Maybe don't begin to get them afraid. Okay, how do you engineer that? What do you do? And then I saw this beautiful piece. Now the Baal Shem Tov says, get help from the Baal Shem Tov from 200 years ago plus. And this is what the Baal Shem Tov says, the following thing. Based upon a verse, in Sefer Me'or Einayim, based upon a verse that the King Solomon says, Ashra ish mefachet tamid, happy is the person who is always afraid. That's a queer thought. Happy is the person who is always afraid, the wisest of all men said. And the Talmud understands that, he says that when thunder comes, we had lightning thunder the other night. It comes to straighten out the wrinkles in a person's heart. So what is that? So he says the following thing. There's nothing independent from the Almighty in the world. Everything being sent by the Almighty. Is this what the Baal Shem Tov says? Shekola pechadim afilum abalei chayim. Any kind of fright that comes, even from wild animals, that reach the person. It's really the intention of the Almighty to frighten the person in order that the person, kidei sheyizkor liyiras Hashem, that the person should remember to have fear and reverence and proper awe of the Almighty. The im ha'adam chocham b'mizbonin, if the person is going to be wise and he's going to think about this, az ein shum davar mefachto laharalo, the thing that he's afraid of will never be able to hurt him. Because he's realized it's a paper tiger. He got the message. I got the message. That this thing that's coming and charging at me, it was really only sent to the Almighty that I should have fear of Hashem. Once I have fear of Hashem, then that thing is, it's done its job, and he can go back, send him back to Hollywood. He doesn't have real teeth. It was only sent there to remind me to be afraid of Hashem. He says because original intention was, the only reason why it would come there to make the person uncomfortable from the Almighty was not that the person should become punished, but that he should come to, it should inhibit him from going to do anything he wants to do. He should realize, I was about to pick up a cheeseburger and suddenly I saw a lightning bolt and I realized, maybe not. You know, I'm about to touch that dial. And I realized, no, don't touch that dial. Life, and maybe this could be I heard about there's a bombing, and I heard now, I remember driving in a bus in Eretz Israel, and we heard there was a bombing up north. Everybody started, even people who didn't look like they were dressed for it, were saying Tefillah Tederach. And they were being polite to each other, because this could be the last person you're sitting next to, your last conversation. And your last act may determine your essence. You want to be nice in the end. People started doing tshuva. The next thing you know, you could be standing in front of the Kiyus HaDin, you could be talking to the Almighty. So it puts a little fright, puts a sense of ultra reality, of ultimate reality. He says, but if the person's not, doesn't get the message, he says, then that thing has sort of, because he gave it an independent value, it could have the independent power to come to hurt him. So now I went back to my verse, and as we finish up, the verse doesn't say, don't be afraid. That's how we deal with terrorism. It says, lo sirim mehem, don't be afraid of them. Be afraid of Hashem. What do you mean, be afraid? Is it? That means, we can't do whatever we want. Can't say whatever we want. The laws of Lashon Hara, there's laws of Kashrus, there's laws of obedience on Shabbos, We're walking in somebody else's house. Walk with respect in the world. With respect to the Almighty's people. Respect for the Almighty's objects. Respect for the Almighty's goodness. Respect. That's what Yerush Hashem means. You don't need to sit and to be frightened all the time. So it's coming to teach us to not to be afraid of them. Don't be afraid of them. But remember the Almighty. Don't forget about the Almighty. The Almighty got us attention. I got the message. So it could be that that's the way that we deal with the ism of nowadays, is the terrorism. Is once we understand, we get that message, the Almighty, you got the message, they don't have to come and bark near my door, they don't have to show their teeth, they don't have to bite. It's a frightening world. But we should know, we know how the movie's going to end. And we know it's going to end good. It means it's going to be some rough and tumble here along the way. And we see all these different crazy signs that are going on around us. It doesn't look like there's any place that's really safe. And all the things that we thought we could rely on, we can't rely on. And all the assumptions that we thought we had are not really assumptions anymore. So it seems like there's only one place to turn anyway. Right? That's what we said at the end of that mission over there. You know, but where are you going to rely on? Which club are you going to join? What are you going to do? So be connected to the Almighty. Be connected to Shabbos. Be connected to Torah. Be connected to learning. Be connected to davening. It's a time of davening. It's a time of doing whatever we can to try to strengthen our relationship with the people that are around us and to strengthen our relationship with the Almighty. That's what we've got. It's not, oh, Nebuch, unfortunately, that's what we got. That's what we got! We got the Almighty. Rabbi Yaakov Emden writes in his Siddur 300 years ago, in the early 1700s, he says, many have tried to injure us, but they were not able to destroy or wipe us out. While all the great ancient civilizations have disappeared and been forgotten, the nation of God, the nation of Israel who clings to Hashem, is alive today. That's the important words. What will the wise historian answer when he examines this phenomenon without prejudice? Was all this purely by chance? By my soul, when I contemplated these great wonders of continued existence, they took on greater significance than all the miracles and wonders that Hashem, blessed be He, performed for our fathers in Egypt, in the desert, and when He entered the land of Israel. And the longer this exile extends, this was written 300 years ago, the miracle of Jewish existence becomes more obvious to make known God's mastery and supervision over nature and history. The Jewish people had not come back to the land of Israel at that point. Now we're back in the land of Israel. Now there's pressure from all sides. So we're waiting to hear good news. You know, it's painful times. But I think that we have to put on our optimistic glasses over here. Not rose glasses, but to put on our picture in our brain that we're producing something. And not to be afraid of them, but to be afraid and to develop and to further and deepen our relationship with the Almighty. I think that's the advice for this particular time. Thank everybody for listening. I know it's not easy. I know it's heavy. I didn't make any broad predictions about anything. It's hard to see around corners. I think it was the Woody Allen, one of the things he said, you know, said, why'd the Holocaust happen? He said, I mean, one of these movies, he said, his father says, you know, I can't open a can of tuna fish. He asked me why the, you know, my, you know, I have trouble, you know, getting this thing to work, you know, the computer to work. And, you know, now you're going to ask me what's happening tomorrow. I don't know what's happening tomorrow. But we have a picture, you know, a general wraparound picture of what we spoke about today. And we see that's a reliable picture. Some of the things that were spoken of from the Tzar, it happened, just as they said. But the Torah says it happened. It's happened, just as it said. It's not, you know, vague predictions. These are not fortune cookie ideas over here. This is very, very solid stuff. This is the newspaper. They're more real and more reliable than even what the newspaper is telling us, what the newscasters are able to tell. So this is who we have to rely on. This is the ones who are giving us the information we need. And if anybody has any questions, they can ask on anything, if you like, and I'll try to do my best. Yes.
This day, early in the morning, began with what you said. On the news, it was written that, it was saying on the news, as Europe is angry at America because Obama is leading from behind. Mm-hmm. Exactly your words. You know, he's leading from behind.
It's symptomatic. Again, it's not a bashing of this particular rabbi. Mm-hmm. If there is no clarity on truth and there's no source of truth, so automatically it goes to whoever is the most, you know, seemingly articulate, whoever speaks the loudest or with the most emotion, or the one who can capture the imagination of more people. That makes it more true. It's a lack of clarity, of general clarity in leadership. The Bible was somehow discredited in the minds of the Western intellectual
truth
world.
Truth is nothing right now.
Yeah.
Because the President of the United States stated to all the people what he's going to give, you know, for health care, no, all of it was a lie. Could you imagine the President of the United States telling the whole world a lie? People can't imagine it.
The bigger the lie, the more unbelievable it is for people to believe that it could be a lie, because if somebody said it, that's a Hitler says this, tell the big lie, but repeat it often enough, and people, he himself, that was the propaganda advice. He himself spelled it out. If you tell the lie, the big lie, often enough, because people lie small to themselves, they wouldn't believe it, you would tell such a big lie. But people tell big lies. You tell a big lie, and people will eventually assume that it must be the truth, because it's just too big for somebody to say a lie. Can't say a big lie like that. Can't. Scary, but but in our heart of hearts, we hear it. And we have to know what the truth is. Sometimes you see people, some people you have to hear their words, you have to watch their actions. It's a little bit of a puppet show. You have to see what they're doing. Don't listen to what they're saying. And other people, you have to hear what they're saying and don't watch what they're doing. All right, any other questions? Yeah, I see a hand about to go up or something. Oh, usually people clap when I'm done, because right. They're glad I'm done. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Oh, question.
I liked very much how you broke it broke history into these 2,000-year chunks. Uh-huh. However, we have always had the outlook to look forward to Messiah and to believe that he can come any time.
Right.
Notwithstanding that, we haven't gone through the fourth millennium, we haven't gone through the fifth.
Right.
So this is something that I try to reconcile.
Right.
Why our generation, and we're so close to 6,000,
right.
And why not our holy great grandparents who lived and breathed Torah and didn't have to have the challenges that we have today. Why is it set up that way?
So the truth is, it's not one generation versus another generation. I'm afraid to get into something too big, but I'm going to explain to you. We say at the Pesach Seder, the whole door of a door. It's a fascinating idea. In every generation, Chayv Adam Liro says, Atzmo Ki Hilu Yos Mitzrayim. We have to see ourselves like we went out of Egypt. So some people make it into a nice morality play. You put a besak on your shoulder, and you do like a little, like, hey, you see, like we're doing like that happened back then, but that was back then, but this is now. Reb Shimon Schwab, Reb Mordechai's brother, had said an amazing idea that in the human body, every 7 years, every cell in your body changes over. Right? Every second, 8 million blood cells die and are replaced. That means this building is, let's say, being replaced, every brick, and yet the picture should remain the picture, even though every, brush stroke was changed over the course, and every brick remained, and it continues to function. Our bodies, every 7 years, every cell in the body rotates out, except the brain cells. So you don't find that somebody, let's say, signed a contract, or let's say got into a marriage. 7 years later, she looks at him, he looks at her, and says, "You're not the woman I married. You're not the man I married." And 14 years later, twice already, you're not the man, you're not the woman, you're not me, and each of us has changed. So we should be able to jump out with no responsibilities out of this relationship. And the mortgage I signed, I shouldn't hurt my credit record if I walk away from this house and I leave it, because, that was me 21 years ago, and 21 years ago that was my cells have changed over. Nobody thinks like that. Because that was me 21 years ago, that's my signature. And he says, when we went out of Egypt, that was us. That's us. And then a couple of years later, it's different cells. We're different cells on the same body. The brain stayed the same. The Torah is the same. The breath is the same. And so that was Moses and Miriam and Aaron back then. And now it's, you plug in the names now. And this is the toenail and the eye and the ear. And we're all part of one body now and one body through history. We're all accomplishing. That was us when we were young. You look back at your baby pictures. That was you when you were young. That was you when you were Bar Mitzvah, that was you when you went to the chuppah. That was you when you walked your own first child to the chuppah. Here we are, a little older, a little crazier, a little whiter, but that's still us back then. So that was us back then, and that's us now. So it's not something that happened just to them. We're all working on one giant project. Reb Miller says, based on the mission of Perkei Avos, Kol Yisrael Yeshlem Chelek Le'olam Haba, all Jews have a portion in the next world. He said it's only if they're part of Kol Yisrael. We want to be part of all Israel. All Israel from the beginning of history, from Avram until Mashiach. We want to be part of the whole picture. That's the important part. That's the accomplishment of Pesach. That's the accomplishment. It's not just something that happened to this generation or that generation. We're coming. We're playing a role in the culmination of the accomplishments of all the generations. I think that that's maybe the more complete way of looking at it. That's why it's called the heels of Mashiach, because it's being built from the top bottom, not like the tall building. It's being built from the head, from Avram, he was the brain, all the way down to the feet. Now, heel means that once the heel is built, then the foundation is put there that supports everything, and now the whole thing is complete. That's the notion of the heels of Mashiach. What's that?
The heel generation.
The heel generation. Yeah. They say time wounds all heels. And time heals all wounds. Okay. All right. Thank you again. Thank you, everybody.
I'd like to thank, on behalf of everybody here, I'd like to thank you, Rabbi Lamb, for your outstanding words. I think one thing that Rabbi Lamb has done for us, he has given us the opportunity to transform ourselves from being passive observers in this crazy world to becoming activists who can make the big dream really happen. That's an enormous accomplishment, and we're grateful to you. I would like to tell you that we have available we have flyers, these golden sheets that are out in all parts of the house over here. 3 weeks from tonight, we have scheduled our next lecture, and because of what's going on today, as you'll see on the sheet, the lecture will also be about a whole different aspect of dealing with this world that we live in today. Please help yourself. Of course, on the sheet you'll also find we have weekly classes, Monday and Wednesday. You're all welcome to join us, and hope to see you soon. Drive home safely. We want to thank Marie and Ken for their spectacular hospitality. And Marie and Ken have prepared some outstanding refreshments, so please come and join and help yourself.
Thank you.
Good. Excellent.
Thank you.
Great to see you.
This is so timely. It's unbelievable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You try to plan it, you could do it. Europe this morning called out a president that you're leading from behind. You're not going to do anything. You're going to make a mess.
Oh, Hashem.
He could have followed you. Yeah.